Cassette 5, Side 2. On the other hand, it would certainly be a good thing if their diplomatic team were to arrive on Earth with a completed document to present to the UN and the people of Earth. Really, there was no avoiding it. They needed to finish, not just to present to Earth the united front of an established government, but also to start living their post-crisis life, whatever it may be. Nadia felt this strongly, and so she began to exert herself. "Time to drop the keystone in the arch," she said to Art one morning. And from then on she was indefatigable, meeting with all the delegations and committees, insisting that they finish whatever they were working on, insisting that they get it on the table for a final vote on inclusion. This inexorable insistence of hers revealed something that hadn't been clear before, which was that most of the issues had been resolved to the satisfaction of most of the delegations. They had concocted something workable, most agreed, or at least worth trying, with amendment procedures prominent in the structure so that they could alter aspects of the system as they went along. The young natives in particular seemed happy, proud of their work, and pleased that they had managed to keep an emphasis on local semi-autonomy, institutionalizing the way most of them had lived under the transitional authority. Thus, the many checks against majoritarian rule didn't bother them, even though they themselves were the current majority. In order not to look defeated by this development, Jackie and her circle had to pretend they had never argued for a strong presidency and central government in the first place. Indeed, they claimed that an executive council elected by the legislature in the Swiss manner had been their idea all along. A lot of that kind of thing was going on, and Art was happy to agree with all such claims. "Yes, I remember. We were wondering what to do about that the night when we stayed up to see the sunrise. It was a good thought you had." Good ideas everywhere, and they began to spiral down toward closure. The global government, as they had designed it, was to be a confederation led by an executive council of 7 members elected by a 2-house legislature. One legislative branch, the Duma, was composed of a large group of representatives drafted from the populace. The other, the Senate, a smaller group, elected one from each town or village group larger than 500 people. The legislature was all in all fairly weak. It elected the executive council and helped select justices of the courts and left to the towns most legislative duties. The judicial branch was more powerful. It included not only criminal courts, but also a kind of double supreme court, one half a constitutional court and the other half an environmental court, with members to both appointed, elected, and drawn by lottery. The environmental court would rule on disputes concerning terraforming and other environmental changes, while the constitutional court would rule on the constitutionality of all other issues, including challenged town laws. One arm of the environmental court would be a land commission charged with overseeing the stewardship of the land, which was to belong to all Martians together, in keeping with point 3 of the Dorsa Brevia Agreement. There wouldn't be private property as such, but there would be various tenure rights established in leasing contracts, and the Land Commission was to work these matters out. A corresponding Economic Commission would function under the Constitutional Court, and would be partly composed of representatives from guild cooperatives which would be established for the various professions and industries. This commission was to oversee the establishment of a version of the underground's eco-economics, including both not-for-profit enterprises concentrating on the public sphere and taxed for-profit enterprises which had legal size limits and were by law employee-owned. This expansion of the judiciary satisfied what desire they had for a strong global government without giving an executive body much power. It was also a response to the heroic role played by Earth's World Court in the previous century, when almost every other Terran institution had been bought or otherwise collapsed under metanational pressures. Only the World Court had held firm, issuing ruling after ruling on behalf of the disenfranchised and the land, in a mostly ignored rearguard and indeed symbolic action against the Metanats' depredations. a moral force which, if it had had more teeth, might have done more good. But from the Martian underground they had seen the battle fought, and now they remembered. Thus the Martian global government. The Constitution then also included a long list of human rights, including social rights, guidelines for the Land Commission and the Economics Commission, an Australian ballot election system for the elective offices, a system for amendments, and so on. Lastly, to the main text of the Constitution they had appended the huge collection of materials that had accumulated in the process, calling it Working Notes and Commentary. This was to be used to help the courts interpret the main document, and included everything the delegations had said at the table of tables, or written on the warehouse screens, or received in the mail. So most of the sticky issues had been resolved, or at least swept under the rug. The biggest outstanding dispute was the red objection. Art went into action here, orchestrating several late concessions to the Reds, including many early appointments to the environmental courts. These concessions were later termed the Grand Gesture. In return, Eriska, speaking for all the Reds still involved in the political process, agreed that the cable would stay, that UNTA would have a presence in Sheffield, that Terrans would still be able to immigrate, subject to restrictions. And lastly, that terraforming would continue in slow, non-disruptive forms until the atmospheric pressure at 6 kilometers above the datum was 350 millibars, this figure to be reviewed every 5 years. And so the red impasse was broken, or at least finessed. Coyote shook his head at the way things had developed. After every revolution, there is an interregnum in which communities run themselves and all is well, and then the new regime comes in and screws things up. I think what you should do now is go out to the tents and canyons and ask them very humbly how they have been running things these past 2 months, and then throw this fancy constitution away and say, continue. But that's what the Constitution does say, Art joked. Coyote would not kid about this. You must be very scrupulous not to gather power into the center just because you can do it. Power corrupts. That's the basic law of politics. Maybe the only law. As for UNTA, it was harder to tell what they thought, because opinions back on Earth were divided, with a loud faction calling for the retaking of Mars by force, everyone on Pavonis to be jailed or hanged. Most Terrans were more accommodating, and all of them were still distracted by the ongoing crisis at home. And at the moment, they didn't matter as much as the Reds. That was the space the revolution had given the Martians. Now they were about to fill it. Every night of the final week, Art went to bed incoherent with cavils and kava, and though exhausted, he would wake fairly often during the night and roll under the force of some seemingly lucid thought that in the morning would be gone or revealed as lunatic. Nadia slept just as poorly on the couch next to his, or in her chair. Sometimes they would fall asleep talking over some point or other, and wake up dressed but entangled, holding on to each other like children in a thunderstorm. The warmth of another body was a comfort like nothing else. And once, in the dim pre-dawn ultraviolet light, they both woke up and talked for hours in the cold silence of the building, in a little cocoon of warmth and companionship, another mind to talk to. From colleagues to friends, from there to lovers, maybe, or something like lovers, Nadia didn't seem inclined to romanticism of any kind. But Art was in love, no doubt about it, and there twinkled in Nadia's flecked eyes a new fondness for him, he thought. So that at the end of the long final days of the Congress, they lay on their couches and talked, and she would need his shoulders, or him hers, and then they would fall comatose, pounded by exhaustion. There was more pressure to ushering in this document than either one of them wanted to admit, except in these moments, huddling together against the cold, big world. A new love. Art, despite Nadia's unsentimentality, found no other way to put it. He was happy. And he was amused, but not surprised, when they got up one morning and she said, "Let's put it to a vote." So Art talked to the Swiss and the Dorsa Brevia scholars, and the Swiss proposed to the Congress that they vote on the version of the Constitution currently on the table, voting point by point as they had promised in the beginning. Immediately there was a spasm of vote trading that made Terran stock exchanges look subtle and slow. Meanwhile, the Swiss set up a voting sequence, and over the course of 3 days they ran through it, allowing one vote to each group on each numbered paragraph of the draft constitution. All 89 paragraphs passed, and the massive collection of explanatory material was officially appended to the main text. After that, it was time to put it to the people of Mars for approval. So on LS-158, 1 October 11th, M year 52, on Earth, February 27th, 2128, the general populace of Mars, including everyone over 5 M years old, voted by wrist on the resulting document. Over 95% of the population voted, and the Constitution passed 78% to 22%, garnering just over 9 million votes. They had a government. Part 4. Green Earth. On Earth, meanwhile, the Great Flood dominated everything. The flood had been caused by a cluster of violent volcanic eruptions under the West Antarctic ice sheet. The land underneath the ice sheet, resembling North America's basin and range country, had been depressed by the weight of the ice until it lay below sea level. So when the eruptions began, the lava and gases had melted the ice over the volcanoes, causing vast slippages overhead. At the same time, ocean water had started to pour in under the ice at various points around the swiftly eroding grounding line. Destabilized and shattering, enormous islands of ice had broken off all around the edges of the Ross Sea and the Rona Sea. As these islands of ice floated away on the ocean currents, the breakup continued to move inland, and the turbulence caused the process to accelerate. In the months following the first big breaks, the Antarctic Sea filled with immense tabular icebergs, which displaced so much water that sea level all over the world rose. Water continued to rush into the depressed basin in West Antarctica that the ice had once filled, floating out the rest of it berg by berg, until the ice sheet was entirely gone, replaced by a shallow new sea roiled by the continuing underwater eruptions, which were being compared in their severity to the Deccan Traps eruptions of the late Cretaceous. And so, a year after the eruptions began, Antarctica was only a bit over half as big as it had been, East Antarctic like a half moon, the Antarctic Peninsula like an iced-over New Zealand, in between them a berg-clotted, bubbling, shallow sea. And all around the rest of the world, sea level was 7 meters higher than it had been before. Not since the last ice age, 10,000 years before, had humanity experienced a natural catastrophe of such magnitude. And this time it affected not just a few million hunter-gatherers in nomadic tribes, but 15 billion civilized citizens living atop a precarious socio-technological edifice which had already been in great danger of collapse. All the big coastal cities were inundated, whole countries like Bangladesh and Holland and Belize were awash. Most of the unfortunates who lived in such low-lying regions had time to move to higher ground, for the surge was more like a tide than a tidal wave. And then there they all were, somewhere between a tenth and a fifth of the world's population, refugees. It goes without saying that human society wasn't equipped to handle such a situation. Even in the best of times it wouldn't have been easy, and the early 22nd century hadn't been the best of times. Populations were still rising, resources were more and more depleted, conflicts between rich and poor, governments and metanats had been sharpening everywhere. The catastrophe had struck in the midst of a crisis. To a certain extent, the catastrophe canceled the crisis. In the face of worldwide desperation, power struggles of all kinds were recontextualized, many rendered phantasmagorical. There were whole populations in need, and legalities of ownership and profit paled in comparison to the problem. The United Nations rose like some aquatic phoenix out of the chaos and became the clearinghouse for the vast number of emergency relief efforts. Migrations inland across national borders, construction of emergency accommodations, distribution of emergency food and supplies. Because of the nature of this work, with its emphasis on rescue and relief, Switzerland and Praxis were in the forefront of helping the UN. UNESCO returned from the dead, along with the World Health Organization. India and China, as the largest of the badly devastated countries, were also extremely influential in the current situation because how they chose to cope made a big difference everywhere. They made alliances with each other and with the UN and its new allies. They refused all help from the Group of 11 and the metanationals that were now fully intertwined into the affairs of most of the G11 governments. In other ways, however, the catastrophe only exacerbated the crisis. The metanationals themselves were cast into a very curious position by the flood. Before its onset, they had been absorbed in what commentators had been called the metanatricide, fighting among themselves for final control of the world economy. A few big metanational superclusters had been jockeying for ultimate control of the largest industrial countries and attempting to subsume the few entities still out of their control: Switzerland, India, China, Praxis, the so-called world court countries, and so on. Now, with much of the population of Earth occupied in dealing with the flood, the metanats were mostly struggling to regain what control they had had of affairs. In the popular mind, they were often linked to the flood as cause or as punished sinners, a very convenient bit of magical thinking for Mars and the other anti-metanational forces, all of whom were doing their best to seize this chance to beat the metanats to pieces while they were down. The Group of 11 and the other industrial governments previously associated with the metanats were scrambling to keep their own populations alive, and so could spare little effort to help the great conglomerates. And people everywhere were abandoning their previous jobs to join the various relief efforts. Praxis-style employee-owned enterprises were gaining in popularity as they took on the emergency, at the same time offering all their members the longevity treatment. Some of the metanats held on to their workforce by reconfiguring along these same lines. And so the struggle for power continued on many levels, but everywhere rearranged by the catastrophe. In that context, Mars, to most Terrans, was completely irrelevant. Oh, it made for an interesting story, of course, and many cursed the Martians as ungrateful children, abandoning their parents in the parents' hour of need. It was one example among many of bad responses to the flood, to be contrasted to the equally plentiful good responses. There were heroes and villains all over these days, and most regarded the Martians as villains, rats escaping a sinking ship. Others regarded them as potential saviors in some ill-defined way, another bit of magical thinking, by and large. But there was something hopeful in the notion of a new society forming on the next world out. Meanwhile, no matter what happened on Mars, the people of Earth struggled to cope with the flood. The damage now began to include rapid climatic changes. More cloud cover reflecting more sunlight and causing temperatures to drop, also creating torrential rainstorms which often wrecked much-needed crops and sometimes fell where rain had seldom fallen before, in the Sahara, the Mojave, northern Chile, bringing the great flood far inland, in effect, bringing its impact everywhere. And with agriculture hammered by these new severe storms, hunger itself became an issue. Any general sense of cooperation was therefore threatened, as it seemed that perhaps not everyone could be fed, and the cowardly spoke of triage. And so every part of Terra was in turmoil, like an anthill stirred by a stick. So that was Earth in the summer of 2128. an unprecedented catastrophe, an ongoing universal crisis. The antediluvian world already seemed like no more than a bad dream from which they had all been rudely awakened, cast into an even more dangerous reality. From the frying pan into the fire, yes. And some people tried to get them back into the frying pan, while others struggled to get them off the stove, and no one could say what would happen next. An invisible vice clamped down on Nergal, each day more crushing than the last. Maya moaned and groaned about it. Michelle and Sax didn't seem to care. Michelle was very happy to be making this trip, and Sax was absorbed in watching reports from the Congress on Pavonis Mons. They lived in the rotating chamber of the spaceship Atlantis, and over the 5 months of the trip, the chamber would accelerate until the centrifugal force shifted from Mars equivalent to Earth equivalent, remaining there for almost half the voyage. This was a method that had been worked out over the years to accommodate emigrants who decided they wanted to return home, diplomats traveling back and forth, and the few Martian natives who had made the voyage to Earth. For everyone, it was hard. Quite a few of the natives had gotten sick on Earth. Some had died. It was important to stay in the gravity chamber, do one's exercises, take one's inoculations. Sax and Michelle worked out on exercise machines. Nergal and Maya sat in the blessed baths, commiserating. Of course, Maya enjoyed her misery, as she seemed to enjoy all her emotions, including rage and melancholy. While Nergal was truly miserable, space-time bending him in an ever more tortuous torque until every cell of him cried out with the pain of it. It frightened him, the effort it took just to breathe, the idea of a planet so massive. Hard to believe. He tried to talk to Michelle about it, but Michelle was distracted by his anticipation, his preparation, Sax by the events on Mars. Nergal didn't care about the meeting back on Pavonis. It wouldn't matter much in the long run, he judged. The natives in the outback had lived the way they wanted to under Unta, and they would do the same under the new government. Jackie might succeed in making a presidency for herself, and that would be too bad. But no matter what happened, their relationship had gone strange, become a kind of telepathy which sometimes resembled the old passionate love affair, but just as often felt like a vicious sibling rivalry, or even the internal arguments of a schizoid self. Perhaps they were twins. Who knew what kind of alchemy Hiroko had performed in the ectogene tanks? But no, Jackie had been born of Esther. He knew that, if it proved anything. For to his dismay, she felt like his other self. He didn't want that. He didn't want the sudden speeding of his heart whenever he saw her. It was one of the reasons he had decided to join the expedition to Earth. And now he was getting away from her at the rate of 50,000 kilometers an hour, but there she still was on the screen, happy at the ongoing work of the Congress and her part in it. And she would be one of the seven on the new executive council, no doubt about it. She's counting on history to take its usual course, Maya said as they sat in the baths watching the news. Power is like matter. It has gravity. It clumps and then starts to draw more into itself. This local power spread out through the tents. She shrugged cynically. Perhaps it's a nova. Nergal suggested. She laughed. Yes, perhaps. But then it starts clumping again. That's the gravity of history, power drawn into centers until there's an occasional nova. Then a new drawing in. We'll see it on Mars, too, you mark my words. And Jackie will be right at the middle of it. She stopped before adding the bitch, in respect for Nergal's feelings. Regarding him with a curious hooded gaze, as if wondering what she might do with Nergal that would advance her never-ending war with Jackie. Little novas of the heart. The last weeks of 1G passed, and never did Nergal begin to feel comfortable. It was frightening to feel the clamping pressure on his breath and his thinking. His joints hurt. On the screens he saw images of the little blue and white marble that was the Earth, with the bone button of Luna looking peculiarly flat and dead beside it. But they were just more screen images. They meant nothing to him compared to his sore feet, his beating heart. Then the blue world suddenly blossomed and filled the screens entirely, its curved limb a white line, the blue water all patterned by white cloud swirls, the continents peeking out from cloud patterns like little rebuses of half-remembered myth. Asia, Africa, Europe, America. For the final descent and aero-braking, the gravity chamber's rotation was stopped. Nergal, floating, feeling disembodied and balloon-like, pulled to a window to see it all with his own eyes. Despite the window glass and the thousands of kilometers of distance, the detail was startling in its sharp-edged clarity. "The eye has such power," he said to Sax. "Mmm," Sax said, and came to the window to look. They watched the earth, blue before them. "Are you ever afraid?" Nergal asked.
"Afraid?"
"You know." Sax, on this voyage, hadn't been in one of his more coherent phases. Many things had to be explained to him. "Fear. Apprehension. Fright."
"Yes, I think so. I was afraid, yes, recently, when I found I was disoriented.
I'm afraid now." Sax looked at him curiously. Then he floated over and put a hand to Nergal's arm in a gentle gesture quite unlike him.
"We're here," he said.
Dropping, dropping. There were 10 space elevators stranding out from Earth now. Several of them were what they called split cables, dividing into 2 branching strands that touched down north and south of the equator, which was woefully short of decent socket locations. 1 split cable, wide down to Virac in the Philippines and Ubaguma in Western Australia, another to Cairo and Durban. The one they were descending split some 10,000 kilometers above the Earth, the north line touching down near Port of Spain, Trinidad, while the southern one dropped into Brazil near Aripuanan, a boom town on a tributary of the Amazon called the Theodore Roosevelt River. They were taking the North Fork down to Trinidad. From their elevator car, they looked down on most of the Western Hemisphere, centered over the Amazon basin where brown water veined through the green lungs of Earth. Down and down. In the 5 days of their descent, the world approached until it eventually filled everything below them, and the crushing gravity of the previous month and a half once again slowly took them in its grasp and squeezed, squeezed, squeezed. What little tolerance Nergal had developed for the weight seemed to have disappeared during the brief return to microgravity, and now he gasped. Every breath an effort. Standing foursquare before the windows, hands clenched to the rails, he looked down through clouds on the brilliant blue of the Caribbean, the intense greens of Venezuela. The Orinoco's discharge into the sea was a leafy stain. The limb of the sky was composed of curved bands of white and turquoise with the black of space above. All so glossy. The clouds were the same as on Mars, but thicker, whiter, more stuffed with themselves. The intense gravity was perhaps exerting an extra pressure on his retina or optic nerve to make the colors push and pulse so hard. Sounds were noisier. In the elevator with them were UN diplomats, Praxis aides, media representatives, all hoping for the Martians to give them some time to talk to them. Nergal found it difficult to focus on them, to listen to them. Everyone seemed so strangely unaware of their position in space, there, 500 kilometers over the surface of the Earth and falling fast. A long last day. Then they were in the atmosphere, and then the cable led their car down onto the green square of Trinidad, into a huge socket complex next to an abandoned airport, its runways like gray runes. The elevator car slid down into the concrete mass. It decelerated. It came to a stop. Nergal detached his hands from the rail and walked carefully after all the others, plod, plod, the weight all through him. Plod, plod. They plodded down a jetway. He stepped onto the floor of a building on Earth. The interior of the socket resembled the one on Pavonis Mons, an incongruous familiarity, for the air was salty, thick, hot, clangorous, heavy. Nergal hurried as much as he could through the halls, wanting to get outside and see things at last. A whole crowd trailed him, surrounded him, but the Praxis aides understood. They made a way for him through a growing crowd. The building was huge. Apparently he had missed a chance to take a subway out of it. But there was a doorway glowing with light. Slightly dizzy with the effort, he walked out into a blinding glare, pure whiteness. It reeked of salt, fish, leaves, tar, shit, spices, like a greenhouse gone mad. Now his eyes were adjusting. The sky was blue, a turquoise blue like the middle band of the limb as seen from space, but lighter. Whiter over the hills, magnesium around the sun. Black spots swam this way and that. The cable threaded up into the sky. It was too bright to look up. Green hills in the distance. He stumbled as they led him to an open car, an antique, small and rounded, with rubber tires. A convertible. He stood up in the back seat between Sax and Maya just to see better. In the glare of light there were hundreds of people, thousands, dressed in astonishing costumes, neon silks, pink, purple, teal, gold, aquamarine, jewels, feathers, headdresses. Carnival, someone in the front seat of the car said up to him. We dress in costumes for Carnival, also for Discovery Day, when Columbus arrived on the island. That was just a week ago, so we've continued the festival for your arrival, too. What's the date? Sax asked. Nergal Day, August 11. They drove slowly down streets lined with cheering people. One group was dressed like the natives before the Europeans arrived, shouting wildly. Mouths pink and white in brown faces. Voices like music, everyone singing. The people in the car sounded like coyote. There were people in the crowd wearing coyote masks. Desmond Hawkins's cracked face twisted into rubbery expressions beyond what even he could achieve. And words. Nergal had thought that on Mars he had encountered every possible distortion of English, but it was hard to follow what the Trinidadians said. Accent, diction, intonation, he couldn't tell why. He was sweating freely, but still felt hot. The car, bumpy and slow, ran between the walls of people to a short bluff. Beyond it lay a harbor district, now immersed in shallow water. Buildings swamped in the water stood in patches of dirty foam rocking on unseen waves. A whole neighborhood, now a tide pool, the houses giant exposed muscles, some broken open, water sloshing in and out their windows, rowboats bobbing between them. Bigger boats were tied to streetlights and power line poles out where the buildings stopped. Farther out, sailboats tilted on the sun-beaten blue, each boat with two or three taut fore-and-aft sails. Green hills rising to the right, forming a big open bay. Fishing boats still coming in through the streets, but the big ships use the bauxite docks down at Point T. See out there? 50 different shades of green on the hills. Palm trees in the shallows were dead, their fronds drooping yellow. These marked the tidal zone. Above it, green burst out everywhere. Streets and buildings were hacked out of a vegetable world. Green and white, as in his childhood vision, but here the two primal colors were separated out, held in a blue egg of sea and sky. They were just above the waves, and yet the horizon was so far away. Instant evidence of the size of this world. No wonder they had thought the earth was flat. The white water sloshing through the streets below made a continuous kurr sound, as loud as the cheers of the crowd. The rank stench was suddenly cut by the smell of tar on the wind.
Pitch Lake down by La Brea, all dug out and shipped away, nothing left but a black hole in the ground and a little pond we use locally. See, that's what you smell, new road here by the water.
Asphalt road, sweating mirages. People jammed the black roadside. They all had black hair. A young woman climbed the car to put a necklace of flowers around his neck. Their sweet scent clashed with the stinging salt haze. Perfume and incense, chased by the hot vegetable wind, tarred and spiced. Steel drums, so familiar in all the hard noise, pinging and panging, they played Martian music here. The rooftops in the drowned district to their left now supported ramshackle patios. The stench was of a greenhouse gone bad, things rotting, a hot, wet press of air, and everything blazing in a talcum of light. Sweat ran freely down his skin. People cheered from the flooded rooftops, from boats, the water coated with flowers floating up and down on the foam, black hair gleaming like chitin or jewels. A floating wood dock piled with several bands playing different tunes all at once. Fish scales and flower petals strewn underfoot, silver and red and black dots swimming. Flung flowers flashed by on the wind, streaks of pure color, yellow, pink, and red. The driver of their car turned around to talk, ignoring the road.
Hear the Douglas play Soaka music, pan music. Listen, that cutting contest. The best 5 bands in Port of Spain.
They passed through an old neighborhood, visibly ancient, the buildings made of small crumbling bricks, capped by corrugated metal roofs or even thatch, all ancient, tiny. The people tiny too, brown-skinned.
The countryside Hindu, the city's black. TNT mixed them, that's Dugla.
Grass covered the ground, burst out of every crack in the walls, out of roofs, out of potholes, out of everything not recently paved by tarry asphalt. An explosive surge of green pouring out of every surface of the world. The thick air reeked. Then they emerged from the ancient district onto a broad asphalt boulevard flanked by big trees and large marble buildings.
Medinat Grab Highs looked big when they first built, but nothing grab as high as the cable.
Sour sweat, sweet smoke, everything blazing green, he had to shut his eyes so that he wouldn't be sick.
You okay?
Insect's word, the air was so hot he couldn't guess its temperature. It had gone off his personal scale. He sat down heavily between Maya and Sax. The car stopped. He stood again with an effort and got out and had trouble walking. He almost fell. Everything was swinging around. Maya held his arm hard. He gripped his temples, breathed through his mouth.
Are you okay? She asked sharply.
Yes, Nirgal said, and tried to nod.
They were in a complex of raw new buildings. Unpainted wood, concrete, bare dirt now covered with crushed flower petals. People everywhere, almost all in carnival costume. The singe of the sun in his eyes wouldn't go away. He was led to a wooden dais above a throng of people cheering madly. A beautiful black-haired woman in a green sari with a white sash belting it introduced the 4 Martians to the crowd. The hills behind bent like green flames in a strong western wind. It was cooler than before and less smelly. Maya stood before the microphones and cameras, and the years fell away from her. She spoke crisp, isolated sentences that were cheered antiphonally. Call and response, call and response. A media star with the whole world watching, comfortably charismatic, laying out what sounded to Nirgal like her speech in Burroughs at the crux point of the revolution when she had rallied and focused the crowd in Princess Park. Something like that. Michelle and Sax declined to speak. They waved Nirgal up there to face the crowd and the green hills holding them up to the sun. For a time as he stood there, he couldn't hear himself think. White noise of cheers, thick sound in the thicker air.
Mars is a mirror, he said in the microphone, in which Terra sees its own essence.
The move to Mars was a purifying voyage, stripping away all but the most important things. What arrived in the end was Terran through and through. And what has happened since, there has been an expression of Terran thought and Terran genes. And so, more than any material aid in scarce metals or new genetic strains, we can most help the home planet by serving as a way for you to see yourselves, as a way to map out an unimaginable immensity. Thus, in our small way, we do our part to create the great civilization that trembles on the brink of becoming. We are the primitives of an unknown civilization. Loud cheers. That's what it looks like to us on Mars, anyway. A long evolution through the centuries toward justice and peace. As people learn more, they understand better their dependence on each other and on their world. On Mars, we have seen that the best way to express this interdependence is to live forgiving in a culture of compassion. Every person free and equal in the sight of all, working together for the good of all. It's that work which makes us most free. No hierarchy is worth acknowledging but this one. The more we give, the greater we become. Now, in the midst of a great flood, spurred by the great flood, we see the flowering of this culture of compassion emerging on both the two worlds at once.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 5 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 6.